What's up, guys? Welcome back to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. Our programming is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code ADVICES for some additional savings, high-quality supplements. If you're a bodybuilder, they've got stuff you need, flat out. All sorts of stuff, from pre-workouts, intra-workouts, post-workouts, protein, and more. Plus, of course, we're sponsored by getazoff.com, and you can use the code either at the Amazon or at the website to get 10% off. Advices 10. Guys, we have a thread over at the Advices group. If you're not a member, by the way, head on over. I know Facebook isn't like the hub that it used to be in life. But you can head over to Facebook. We have a group there. It's a good place where, you know, like-minded people who listen to the shows can get together. We have question threads there. We post up, you know, different shows that are coming up, shows that have happened. Plus, we post the live stuff, too. So if you guys want to watch us live, you can go there. I'm looking at a question from Brandon Goldberg right now. Oh, no, I'm not. That's actually a drugs and stuff question. I have to keep scrolling up. Here it is. This is from Brian. He says, "What's up, guys? Question from Muscle Minds. I'd really like to hear Dr. Scott's input. Should one perform static stretching on a muscle part the day after it's been trained, or would that impair muscle recovery? Would those static stretches not affect the muscle tissue in the same way as load damage, or would they, even though they are a different type of stimulus to the muscle?" I ask because I'm constantly trying to correct forward shoulder and head posterior problems. I typically will stretch my pecs and delts on a daily basis, but I'm wondering if post-chest training days should be avoided.
I didn't see that second part of the question, so let me go take a look at that because that's important. Okay. I'll start addressing it though while I look it up.
Okay.
So some of this depends on how aggressive the stretching is. So if you're going bonkers, you know, with stretching, that could possibly impair performance.
Yes.
One of the things that happens, and he sort of, this is why I want to make sure I'm on that. Let me see if I can find that here. Question. Maybe even if you just bump that up, Scott, I could find it.
Oh,
but right. One of the things that I'm looking here. I'm getting close. One of the things that happens because people are sitting at their desks all the time, and people who especially are sort of desk bound.
How about people that are on their microphones and like leaning?
Yeah, hunching forward on their, or just on their phones.
Sure, sure.
You know,
typing and just all of this.
Okay. So he posted this twice then, because this was, I think this was something different. Anyway.
Okay.
Constantly trying to correct shoulder and head postural problems.
Yeah.
So a couple things here. There's, for instance, putting a muscle on stretch will prevent any atrophy that can happen. For instance, when it's been, or not any, but to a large extent, it will prevent more than 50% in most cases, most studies that I've looked at, when they cast. For instance, you have your arm cast at 90 degrees if you've had, you know, some sort of a biceps injury or what have you. Or just if just the arm is casted for whatever reason, let's say some sort of a surgery on the bones, the triceps, because it's under stretch, is gonna atrophy less than the biceps.
I'll be damned, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was talking to someone the other day. Actually, he posted sort of about this on Facebook, and you see in people with spinal cord injuries, a lot of times it depends on what they do with their spasticity. Medications. So a lot of times they'll take anti-spasticity medication so they don't get cramps all the time. Like literally they'll get this phenomenon, like it's called clonus, where it's sort of like this reverberating self-feed-forwarding type of spasticity where their legs will just start going like this. The plantar flexion of the calf will push their leg up if they're sitting in a chair, and then it'll come back down, and then you'll get a stretch reflex, and the leg will just go bouncing up and down like that. You'll have to push it out, like dampen it. It's a pain in the ass for some people.
Yeah.
But it also prevents some atrophy because it gives you muscle contractions, so the disuse isn't as big. But for people who do use those meds, if you look at the atrophy in the legs, you'll see it, you know, pretty widespread. But a lot of times they'll sit with their feet plantar flexed, so their toes pointed, and the anterior tibialis, so the front of the shin, that muscle won't atrophy nearly as much.
Huh.
So one of the things that I try to do myself is stretch my pecs because I'm sitting at my desk as much as possible.
Yeah.
So also, and I've mentioned this before, I think I've covered some of this information in a previous question. I know I have, but you're setting up the resting muscle length, meaning, you know, what is the way in which the actin and myosin overlaps, how the connective tissue, is basically creating the larger structure of the muscle, the fascia, by what your posture is.
Okay.
So imagine if, you know, just kind of forget about the idea of atrophy. You were always seated, so your hip flexors were always shortened.
Yeah.
So, and you sat that way for even just a week, you would be really tight getting back up. And if you sat that way for months or for years, as some people do, then that connective tissue is going to model itself around that resting length to some degree.
Yeah.
So if you take a muscle, like just imagine, you know, the biceps that's shortened, or the pec muscles that are in this sort of shortened position because you're slumping your shoulders forward, then you're basically setting up the muscle to be smaller. Because you're everything's shortened, and it's not going to be it's just not going to be have the same volume as if you had it in a stretch position. So the casting and like that example with the spinal cord injury all demonstrate that. Huh. So there's something about stretch and setting up that I mean, just think of it this way. Imagine you've got a fiber that's this long, and then you just shorten it chronically to that long.
Right.
What's going to happen is it's going to set up the actin and myosin and those little sarcomeres that run the length of the fiber. So that those are at pretty close to optimal overlap along the length of the fiber at that shortened position. That means it's going to mean less actin and myosin because a sarcomere is a standardized length. So maybe this isn't an accurate number, but let's say it's 10 sarcomeres here and it's 7 sarcomeres here, but if you're chronically stressed, it might be 12 sarcomeres.
Oh wow! Okay,
so that's a huge difference in the amount of simple contractile material you'll have.
Yeah.
So there's that. The stretching is probably a good idea because there's actually a study where they looked at some of those effects of casting in mice, and they had various different groups that they used for this, but they wanted to figure out like what was the minimal amount of activity during the course of what was otherwise an immobilization paradigm model to prevent some of that from happening. It was like 30 minutes over the course of a day.
Okay.
So they have these little mice and they cast their leg and then they would knock them out and take the cast off so they could just do some passive stretching, just wiggle their leg around back and forth for half an hour a day. So that's, you know, that's a half an hour out of a 24-hour day, which is like, you know, like 4% of the day or something like that, roughly, I guess. Is that right? Yeah. 8% of the day.
Okay.
No, 4%. Yeah. Really something like that. It's a very small percentage.
Yeah.
So you can undo, that shortening effect just by doing some amount of stretching. You can do it periodically throughout the day. But if you start doing things like leaning up against the door and doing the door stretch for your pecs, you know, then you could possibly, if you're really going after it, create an impairment potentially on your recovery.
Oh, okay. So
of your recovery. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You mean that would actually be like tearing more fibers down.
Possibly. Yeah, possibly. I mean, if you really like, if you went like, oh, just go to my home gym and I'll grab the dumbbells and do like, you know, a 60 or 90 second extreme stretch, all the DC training.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would then be another stimulus for muscle growth. It would be like adding, in a sense, adding a load stimulus, like another mini training session. Yeah. Brian's probably not doing that, I'm guessing. But without a doubt, like a passive stretch that's like not horribly painful is a good idea. And also, too, and we talked about this a little bit in our conversation. We kind of like we're heading towards the topic of if you set yourself up to have good flexibility, it gives you a larger active range of motion.
Okay.
Just around the joint, and it just gives you more degrees of freedom. Mm. So if you're doing like, for instance, a pec fly, where you might tend to have a tear when you're in that really stretched position, and your pecs are really short. If you get down to that position where they're used to being, you could be at sort of your end range of motion, and you could potentially cause a muscle injury because that everything's tight there because you haven't been stretching it.
Yeah.
So that the whole idea, like the literature is not really, doesn't strongly point to the idea of stretching being the greatest preventative, although some studies have demonstrated this for injuries. It's not a bad idea, in my opinion. So as long as you don't overdo it.
Now, what about stretching? It, while we're talking about it, the first thing I think of now is that I'm terrible with stretching, and it's something that I forget when I say I'm terrible with it. It's something that I forget to add in. But I do like to add it in, you know, having seen like the DC stretches and then having seen other people incorporate them that I've worked out with or people that I've respected that have suggested, you know, adding stretches in maybe at the end of a workout. How beneficial do you find stretching to be for growth?
Well, it's a part of fortitude training. It's the part that people forget the most. Pretty much. It's the part that's really sort of funny when we go and I do a fortitude training camp and we go into the gym.
Yeah.
And like, we'll, a lot of times we'll just start with legs because everyone's kind of fresh after the morning lecture, gets everyone going.
Okay.
And then you do the stretches and people have me doing like, holy, when I show them how I would typically have people do the stretch, they're like, holy shit. Yeah. And people who have been doing often say like, this is the worst part of the training.
Does it make that much of a difference in your results?
I like for instance, one thing that I noticed, and the main effect was in starting to do them for the first time because of the novelty of it. But this was way back in the DC training days.
Yeah.
So one of the things people will say, and here's kind of my explanation for that, is that stretching creates better muscle separation.
Okay.
It's like, okay, how's that happening? Well, that's something you can see in the quads. And so imagine you've done your quad training, you're squatting, what have you, and you maybe typically don't have a whole lot of rectus femoris activation.
Okay.
And maybe you don't do a lot of leg lifts or sit-up type movements where you've got the rectus femoris, which is a hip flexor, getting trained sort of indirectly during those movements. So the two of the big things about resistance exercise that makes it a good stimulus for growth is the tension.
Okay.
And potentially the metabolic stress. And that's a whole other topic that's really kind of fascinating. But you can have low tension and create metabolic stress with blood flow restriction and get muscle growth. Mm. There's still some nuances there that, you know, maybe we can talk about later. But so those things are important, and you can grow from isometric contractions.
Yeah.
And you can grow something about stretch is also important in and of itself. There's the stretch overload model, which with Quayle that Dante used to talk about all the time, which is, it's sort of a stretch, pun intended, to say that body of literature is directly applicable, because that's like a 24-hour around-the-clock load on the muscle that was growing in those Quayle,
okay,
which is very different than doing a 90-second extreme stretch.
Yeah.
But go back to the person who's just trained their legs, and now they do a quad stretch. You know the quad stretch, you just kind of reach back behind your back and you grab your ankle?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I would have people do that usually either on a bench or find like the round pads that you see on like a lot of pull-down machines to hold your legs down under.
Yeah, yeah.
Put your foot up on top of a pad like that.
Okay.
And then sink down so you get the knee flexion, so your heel's on your butt, and then drive your hips forward.
Oh, wow.
So that stretches the quad.
Yeah.
And that stretches the rectus femoris and the hip flexors too.
Sure.
And for someone who's never done that before, especially that kind of stretch, and you've done that, I would call this in my training system an occlusion stretch. So you get into that stretch position and you've got a good pump. And once you're in that position, the muscle is so full anyway,
yeah,
you're not getting any blood flow in there, just probably from the stretch in and of itself. But that you superimpose upon that a voluntary contraction.
Yeah.
And you keep trying to deepen the stretch as you go. So that rectus femoris now is being stretched because it crosses the knee, and it's being stretched because you're driving your hips forward,
yeah,
pulling the hips in a hip extension, which stretches the hip flexor. In this case, we're talking about the rectus femoris. That muscle will burn like a mofo if you haven't been doing those at all, like freaking crazy, and it produces growth there. So yeah. Now go back to this idea of separation in the quad,
yeah,
as an example, is you've got medialis on the inside, lateralis on the outside, and the rectus femoris is right in between. And the muscles kind of come here, and the rectus femoris is kind of this mound in between them.
Right.
So imagine you the medialis and the lateralis are here, and then you've got just kind of a flat little rectus femoris because it's not developed.
Yeah.
And now you make it more developed, so it's bigger and rounder.
More separation.
Well, that crevice in between muscles is what gives us the notion of separation.
Yeah.
You can see the separate between the muscles.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you develop them more fully.
Huh, okay.
So that's like the kind of the most obvious example of this. But take any muscle that you learn how to stretch, and the things that I would say, like, you know, like when Dave and I, we did a lot of these stretches, and you kind of have to, we would try to encourage each other, Dave Henry, when we were doing DC training together.
Yes.
And I would tell people this, who I've trained with the fortitude training, is now it gives you you've got different options with the stretch, but let's say you did a lot of like lower pec training that day, because fortitude training is, it's a high frequency, so the volume of each workout isn't tremendous. So you may not have hit the entire muscle, you know, with 19 different exercises the way some people would do. They want to get everything all at once.
Right.
So you may sense when you go into that stretch that you didn't get as much upper pec as you wanted to, or you just really didn't target the lower pec as much as you want. You still got something there.
Yeah.
Well, when you go into that stretch, and either you use a load in some way, so like if it were a lower pec, you could like load up a dip belt and go into a deep stretch on a dip setup. Or use a decline bar, like in a power rack where the safeties are set up, so you can go down low and then just roll it, you know, up out of the way, so you don't, you know, end up choking yourself out with the bar
right. When
you're done. But that would be an extreme stretch. Or simply like get into like a power rack or a doorway and stretch at the angle at your shoulder that hits that lower pec, and then you contract that muscle.
Yeah.
The first is an extreme stretch, what Dante called them. I just use the same terminology. The other one I call an occlusion stretch. You're creating an occlusion effect with the stretch, which has a superimposed contraction on it. And now you've got a chance to, we might talk about mind-muscle connection if we get to it today, but now you have a chance to deepen that mind-muscle connection as well as hit the muscle in ways that you might have missed with those. So you can tell, like, I got a little bit left there. I just didn't absolutely destroy my lower pec.
Okay.
And that was kind of what I wanted to do today with the exercises I chose. So you can go after it even more so. Or if you got the lower pec and you feel like you need more upper pec, which almost everyone does, then you just change the angle of the stretch. You do it instinctively, and then you contract there. So it's a way to add variety to your training, both in terms of how the muscle is hit, so to speak. So even go back to that quad stretch. You might go into that stretch and be like, okay, my rectus femoris is trashed. I don't need to like drive my hips forward and focus on that. But I feel like my vastus medialis isn't as developed as I want it to be. And I just didn't get a great pump with whatever I did today.
Yeah.
You focus on contracting that. And you got 60 to 90 seconds to just set yourself up where you've got the best mind-muscle connection.
Yeah.
So the stretch can be a very targeted stimulus, because it's got the load, it's got metabolic stress during the stretch to produce muscle growth. And the nice thing about it is, about stretches, you know, with some limitations, you can't go every direction, but you can go into the stretch, and like if you get on a decline Hammersmith machine, for instance, it's going to be, there's not much you can do. You can drop the seat down maybe to hit more upper pec, but the machine or the exercise itself is going to dictate where the muscle, how the muscle is hit, the activation pattern that's there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But you can go into those stretches and change the stretch. You're doing a hamstring stretch with an occlusion on top of it. Maybe you externally rotate a little bit and try to get the biceps femoris, the lateral hamstring, and you work on that. So you can literally pick the nature, dictate the nature of the stress that you get with the stretch as you go into the stretch, and find out what you need to do, or decide what you need to do in terms of getting the whole muscle hit that day, or re-emphasizing something you maybe not didn't stress as much as you wanted to with the exercises of that day. So that's what I have people do, but that's only after you've trained the muscle, because that aggressive stretching beforehand will very likely impair performance.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It's a brutal stretch. You know, the stretches that I've done, like the DC style stretches, they're not easy, man. And I have to have like a clock there to look at.
Oh, yeah.
because otherwise, if I tried to do it for like whatever 30 seconds, I'll be like 15 seconds in it. I'll be like, this has got to be over by now. And I look at the clock. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God, I'm only halfway, yeah. You know, or I'm only 10 seconds in. It's like, you will cut it short, you know, if you're not actually like timing it.
Yeah. I set a timer on my watch.
Yeah.
You know, I've got loan for like a minute and 45 seconds.
Okay.
So it gives me 15 seconds to get set up. And then I know I've got at least 90 seconds if I'm going to do a 90 second stretch.
Whew. And that's a lot, man. 90 seconds. You're going to be,
they're brutal.
You're going to be feeling that, you know?
It's like they're hard as shit. They're hard as absolute hell. That's why people would just blow them off, because they're so difficult.
Okay.
But it teaches pain tolerance, I think, too.
Okay.
That's any set that lasts 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Is a difficult. That's like a Widowmaker type of set.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can create a better stimulus with that. Someone asked about how did she word it here. This was Sally Kellaway. Thank you for the help in fleshing out the question, as she said. Active stretching. So that's sort of like, I'm going to toss that into like, you know, stretching in the way we just talked about with maybe some tension there where someone is, or even moving around. Like you can have, like someone could stretch your hamstring for you, do a little bit of bouncing or almost like squatting down. Like one thing that people will do, and this sort of blends together with mobility work.
Okay.
A good idea for some people if they're going to squat, and you've been talking about squatting deep a lot lately,
uh-huh.
is like get down into that low squat position.
Okay.
And just ease your way down there, maybe by bouncing around a little bit and getting connected with the muscles and activating them in the way you want in that deep, deep squatting position.
Sure.
But that kind of stretching, like in plyometrics too, which sometimes can be considered stretching if you're going, allowing a deep stretch to happen, those will dampen the myotatic stretch reflex, which can impair performance. So the thing, and here's the thing, like this is just like a general recommendation. If you're going to create, if I had to choose one or the other, the stretch as the stimulus for growth or resistance exercise, I'm going to take the resistance exercise.
Sure.
So I want that. I wanted that to be as pure of a stimulus as it can be. And if I went after it with the stretching aggressively, first and foremost, before the resistance, the chances are you're going to impair what you can do there, either just because you're getting psychologically fatigued or like literally you're using up glycogen as well. Like if you're in a pre-contest situation, you're going to create some glycogen use and potentially run low on fuel, especially if someone's doing a high volume type of thing. So you'll end up having a lot of junk volume at the end.
Okay.
Whereas, here's the thing, we know from the blood flow restriction literature that you can use very light loads with blood flow restriction, so amplify that metabolic stress and get growth where you otherwise wouldn't with like really, really low loads.
Okay.
Although you can take those low loads to failure and still get growth. But the metabolic stress is important. So if you go and train first and you've gotten a pump and you've produced the metabolic stress and you don't wait around for 20 minutes, you literally finish your set, clean up your work area, wherever it is, and then go to your stretch, you still got metabolic stress in place. So it means that you're going to have a greater relative metabolic stress component.
Yeah.
During that stretch where you won't need to have a whole bunch of weight.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's the big caveat. And like Dante told me of a few, I haven't had anyone do this because I'm really pretty careful. And not that Dante wasn't, but just people will just be knuckleheads. He had some guy like who literally, I think maybe even threatened to sue him or something like that. Cause he was doing like, you know, pec stretches with the 200-pound dumbbells or some shit like that, and he hurt himself.
I bet he did.
He was using heavier. What's that?
I bet he hurt himself.
Yeah, it was just and like you know, just stretching like to the when the joints are hurting and like it's like way overkill, just stupidness. So if you want the tension, you want the metabolic stress. Low tension will still get the job done.
Yeah.
Especially you know if you're doing the stretch and you've just got done beating the shit out. Let's say you just train legs.
Yeah.
And you're just like, you know, you're just barely with it anyway, you know, because you just destroyed yourself. You don't want to like be going and getting deep into a stretch, let's say it's a hamstring stretch, for instance, where you'll have a tendency to hold your breath because you don't have the cadence or the rhythm of the reps.
Okay.
You hold your breath and you end up passing out or something stupid like that.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to do the stretch with, 405 pounds on a stiff-legged deadlift.
Yeah.
You don't need that if you've already done, hamstring work and all your leg work beforehand. Huh. So you can go lighter on the stretch and still get the benefit. And that's just – it's just better for your joints.
Yeah.
Two, you never want to stretch beyond the normal range of motion of the joint. Like, that's what people were doing is like, trying to like hyperextending their knees. This one guy was hyperextending his knees.
Oh, doing man, stupid that shit,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Totally unnecessary.
But I think it's important you tell us that because I feel like people will think, well, more stretch. Yeah. Go beyond that normal range. You know what I mean? Go beyond your limits. Yeah. Because that may be good. I could see making that mistake myself. So,
and the thing is, you want a voice of reason resonating, especially if you're like in the zone.
Yeah.
And you're like, now I'm gonna stretch the fuck out of this thing, man. I'm going for it. Fuck it. Throw another plate on there. And you go in and you do something stupid. It's better to like kind of, this is going to be plenty hard if I just use one plate with 135 pounds. I don't need to use 315 for the stiff-legged deadlift.
Huh. And so I wanted to throw in, too, for anybody who is watching this that isn't familiar with Dr. Scott, that you're referencing Fortitude Training, which we do have links in the description. That's his training plan. You can get the ebook for like $20, I believe it is. So I'd say if you want to learn more about it, definitely check that out. And that's kind of, you've evolved from having been involved with DC training for a long time where there was a lot of, active stretches going on with that. So just to kind of seat that for anybody who isn't familiar with you or what you're talking about when you're talking about the stretch component of Fortitude.
Yeah, it's a way to auto-regulate the training too. So that's why I have one stretch is just like a static, I call it a flexibility stretch.
Okay.
So it's just not a bad idea just to like kind of test out the full range of motion of the muscle and the joints involved. So like 20-second stretch, just sort of, sometimes you'll find out like, oh shit, I kind of tweaked myself on that. I didn't know that. I finished my last set and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna have to pay attention to that. Like, maybe there's something I should do, because if you hadn't done that stretch, you wouldn't have even noticed it until maybe the next day or what have you, when you've already got an inflammatory process that's sort of running amok if you're someone who wants to do that.
Okay. Somebody said my volume was a little bit low. I'm not sure. Okay. They said your volume is low, Scott.
So that helps.
I don't know. McNally. All right. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I'll try to bring it up a little bit here.
The thing with let me say too, with the DC had just the extreme stretch.
Guys. Yeah.
But I included the occlusion stretch as an idea because doing an extreme stretch like for your quads, by definition you have to use a weight.
Yeah.
Isn't always it's not the best way to stretch the quads. You're not gonna easily get like that stretch in the rectus femoris.
Okay.
You could like try to do that like while holding a dumbbell or something, but it just like doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And it's also a way to like I said, fine tune the stimulus of the stretch. Mm. So I remember, and this isn't a critique of DC, this program is absolutely awesome. But there have been times when you can do like the pec stretch with a pec fly machine or dumbbells. You could even do it with a barbell or a Swift machine too, but you might not get the same range of motion.
Yeah.
But there have been times like you go into that. I would go into that stretch. And I'm like, it's like one of this. Like this is a little bit too much.
Okay.
Like this is like the pain of going to the stretch. It's immediately sharp. Like this is probably not what I need to be doing today. So. Oh. But I can still do a really sort of intensive stretch by doing an occlusion stretch where I change the angle and find the angle where I don't have sharp pain in my pec. Mm. And you contract as hard as what feels normal for you. So it could be all out like gut wrenching from the get go, like you're giving birth, like you're having an exorcism, something like that, Or it can be just, I'm going to just create a little tension here at this angle because this is where I feel I need it. Or I don't need to be stretched. I'm just going to do a flexibility stretch, 20, 30, 40 seconds,
okay,
and that's plenty.
So if he's sitting at his desk, just mild stretches, stuff like that, that's not going to be a problem. That's not going to – it sounds like that's what you're telling me. That's not going to affect his gains whatsoever.
No. In fact, you know, I have found if I don't, sometimes not doing some of that stretching that I typically try to remember to do, I come back. What's that?
I got to start stretching now.
Oh, we all do. Yeah. Pretty much too much true for anyone, unless you're like a yoga instructor,
yeah.
You know, but, then I sometimes I'm not as sore.
Really?
So yeah. Or I'm more sore when I don't do the stretching. So if I do the stretching, the soreness is a little bit less. So it's that's just an N of one, but, you know, it may be something to do too with the fact that, you know, imagine this, like imagine you train chest just once a week.
Okay.
And that's I'm not saying that's, you know, that works well for lots of people.
Yeah.
Or once every 5 days or what have you. And like this range of motion, like from here and deeper, where you tend to want to go on a lot of your exercises, you never experienced that at all during the other, you know, 4 days and 23 hours of the time between your two workouts.
Yeah.
Not at all. So what's that? I mean, that's not probably the best scenario for, you're not even producing any sort of passive range of motion through that amount of stretch on the muscle. So I think it's good just for that reason, for this connective tissue turnover idea.
Yeah.
It takes a while too. I believe the half-life of collagen is like 90 days or something like that. It probably changes.
Oh, wow.
Over time. But yeah, so it takes a while to, that's why you'll see studies that really don't suggest the stretching doesn't change much about the architecture. You'll see changes in the fascicle length and angles.
Yeah.
But you don't see much. And you wouldn't expect that you would even necessarily, because it's not like you're lengthening the bones across which the muscle is connecting. Like, you know, if you had like a car and you had a rubber band that went from the front tire to the back tire and you stretch that all the time, the distance between the wheels, the frame is still the same.
Right.
You know, it's not like all of a sudden the rubber band is going to become longer, but changes in the flexibility is what you want. So
yeah.
At rest, you wouldn't expect much to happen with flexibility or with length of the muscle, because you've still got the same car, you've still got the same length of your bones.
Yeah.
The distance between the origin and the insertion and origin are the same.
And that's not going to change. So
yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The other thing too, the mobility work thing, I always do this. Sometimes people call it, I think, priming.
Okay.
I kind of have to, and this would probably help Brian, I'm guessing, because I feel like I have to sort of stretch out a little bit, lightly prime, so to speak. The priming is more about sort of activating the nervous system.
Yeah.
Sort of neurological warm-up, which involves moving through the range of motion of the exercise or exercises you want to do. So you're not trying to increase flexibility. You're not trying to create a stimulus for muscle growth. You're not trying to become a yogi or gain new range of motion. You're just using like an unloaded version of the exercise. It could even be like, you know, you could consider priming even like just like leaning against a doorway like that and just sort of moving around in that deep part of the range of motion that you'll use for a press.
Okay.
Just to sort of get things warmed up neurologically. So that's helpful for me psychologically. And plus, I just feel like I had this sense that if I were to just not do that, that I would just be begging for an injury.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right.
So
let's see what else we've got here. Right. Was there anything that jumped out to you, Scott, on our question thread that you you wanted to get in today?
So many. Ed Kammeyer's actually, he's such a good dude. He sends me messages and we interact fairly regularly.
Was this the triathlon lady?
Yeah. So a lady close to me is training for a triathlon. Her coach has suggested that she should not lose weight while she's training.
Okay.
But health-wise, the person wants to shed about 10 pounds. Is there a benefit to keeping excess weight on while training for endurance sports like this? Hmm. So he kind of answered his own question by calling it excess weight.
Okay.
Because if it's excess, it's not useful.
Huh.
Otherwise, it would be excess. So the for most people, being lighter is going to be helpful, except that the body fat is buoyancy when you're in the water if you're doing a triathlon.
Oh.
And it could, you know, like the best, like English Channel swimmers, I think this still is the case. I don't follow the the world records for swimming in the English Channel, but like a lot of those deep sea swims where the water is just like crazy cold, the women are the best at that.
Really?
Okay. They tend to have, in many cases, women have held the record of that over men. And you don't see that in like the Olympics.
Yeah.
You don't see that even in, I don't think, in endurance sports where the water temperature is controlled because you got an indoor pool or maybe an outdoor pool in a, you know, more temperate climate. But you get in that cold water and it's good insulation.
That's interesting.
And it's flotation.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you what, man, I used to be a great swimmer when I was a kid. I would say that like swimming was my number one skill in life. Yeah. Well, you know, among other things that I was good at, but swimming was like, I really excelled and like, I had the opportunity to, you know, do a lot of really cool stuff in the water. By the time that I was 15, I became certified with scuba diving, did a lot of snorkeling. And anytime I'd ever been to like the Caribbean and we were snorkeling and swimming, we would see the guys that would, you know, go like dive 70 feet down and go through the caverns and come up the other side.
Divers.
And I could do all that. Like, I was really good at this, man. And I'd just be in the water swimming for hours. And then I stopped. I stopped swimming. You know, there's no real lakes if you don't go out and search them out. I don't live on a lake, for instance, you know.
Right.
Stayed here in Detroit, kept lifting weights, worked, lift weights, never went swimming. And then finally, I decided 4 years ago, I went to Belize and I ended up in a river. We were going to this cave exploration thing, crossing this river. I was like, oh yeah, I've swam all my life. And the water was high due to a lot of rain. Scott, I almost drowned. Like,
no shit.
Yeah, it was normally like you could walk through the river, but due to the high waters, you had to swim. And so I had a backpack with me and we're fully clothed. I've got shoes on and stuff. And they're like, yeah, just there's a rope that goes across, and they're like, just hold onto the rope and you can just swim across with it. Man, I sunk like a rock, Scott. And then I've realized since I've tried, man, I cannot swim. I have no ability to float. Like I just have to paddle and paddle to hold myself up. And the second I stop, man, I go back under. So it's, it definitely, there's something to be said, man. Cause I used to be such a good swimmer and now, man, I'm kind of scared to go in water over my head.
Fuck that. You need to get in a pool or something.
I have, dude. Like, I mean, I've tried. But
really?
Yeah, what I mean is like...
Yeah, I guess.
What I mean is, like, I'm scared because it's kind of like I have no ability to save myself. It's not like I have a phobia. It's just like, fuck, there's nothing I can do, you know? It's
terrifying. Yeah, I bet you could. I mean, like, you swim like Rocky in I don't know which movie it was where they had him swimming.
I don't know. I don't remember him swimming.
Oh, he was just like slapping the water, you know.
I'm a good swimmer.
It may have been Rocky III. I can't remember.
I'm a good swimmer. I mean, I took classes all the time when I was a kid, and I was like all but a certified lifeguard. You know, I'm an open water scuba diver. Like I said,
did you swim competitively, like on the swim team, that kind of thing?
No, I didn't on the swim team. But what I mean though is like I know how to swim, but the second that I stop, there's no floating. I just boom. I go down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy, man. I've talked to other people that are into lifting weights, the same thing. It's just there's like zero flotation. So,
yeah. I was captain of my high school swim team.
Were you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I sink more now, but I don't have any problem swimming.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can tell the difference because I'm, you know, I was, you know, 160 pounds or something like that, then.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I'm a little heavier. Yeah, and a lot of it's muscle.
So I'm taking us a little bit off topic there, but I had to throw my story in about swimming since you were talking.
You know that there's an interesting topic that you sort of brought up that I've seen people. It's been popping up on YouTube, and it's probably because did you see the Joe Rogan interview with Ronnie Coleman?
Not yet. I have to listen to it this week before Bodybuilding Nerd.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's Ronnie, you know.
Yeah,
it's just like amazing. Like you know, the thing that I pieced together. This is sort of getting us further astray, but. I had the sense, and I sort of had this before, that he had some back issues. He had a back injury when he was a kid that I didn't know that he had hurt his back earlier, and then it happened again in college maybe. I had the sense that a lot of his back injuries were due to a botched surgery or maybe the fact that he had the one injury and then the surgery wasn't adequate for taking care of the initial disc injury, but they just kept on adding and adding and adding shit. And that like, It wasn't it, like what we see now in terms of like all the hardware in his spine.
Yeah.
That probably because Ronnie's not a complainer. And also it seems like, I mean, he hasn't taken upon himself that I could tell, because he doesn't know the terminology. He doesn't know what the procedures were. You know, you talk to some people and it's like, yeah, I had an endoscopic disectomy at L4 and L5. And, you know, they did, you know, a laminectomy at the, and they know what, you know, the doctors call the stuff because they've had it done. And they want to, Ronnie didn't, he couldn't remember what some of the things were, and some of it's because so much of it, but I have a feeling that is, and I want to get like sued here, but I have a feeling that like some of it was like surgical issues that and maybe who knows that he did so much, but I've always thought like it was just, he just destroyed his spine, you know, with all the lifting, but he had a pre-existing injury, which is one thing. And then it seems like he had some surgeries that definitely, like, there's always some percentage. So it may have nothing to do with the proficiency of his surgeon, but like he just got like bad. He had bad luck again and again and again. It sort of avalanched in that way, snowballed, so to speak. But the one thing he says, and people are like, oh my God, like this is bullshit. Oh, yeah, he says that you saw this part about his body fat percentage?
Yeah, well, go ahead and tell us. Yeah,
well, I figure we can address it, because you're talking about how people weighing more underwater when they lifted. So the number that was spat out when he did hydrostatic weighing, that's underwater weighing in the weigh tank, was at one point like 0.33%.
Yeah.
And he said he never got above like 3% when they would do, I think, calipers.
Okay.
With the police department. And one time he mentioned this, first said the 0.3, and then he said it was also like negative, I think he said negative 2%.
Okay.
So that is an error in the underlying assumptions that are the basis of those equations.
Huh.
So I don't know exactly what he had done. There's different ways you can do this, but so this is kind of, it's a good topic for people to understand, because people like the body fat thing.
Yeah.
I've written an article on John Meadow's site. People can go and look into this. So for the longest time before DEXA came around, you can actually use MRI and CAT scans too to do body comp.
Really?
But DEXA is an easier one. People would use underwater weighing, and it's based on Archimedes' principle. So the amount of fluid or water in this case that's displaced represents the volume, and you can figure out how much fluid's displaced that way. So I think Archimedes supposedly had this, he recognized this was kind of like the equivalent of the apple falling on Newton's head. Mm-hmm. Archimedes got into the bathtub, and when I think maybe I'm totally making this up, but maybe that just heard this explanation given, but you get in the bathtub and the water overflowed.
Yeah.
It's because his volume of his body displaced X amount of water. You could actually measure that. People may have done this in their science classes in high school or something like that. And if you weigh something and you figure out how much water it's displaced, mass over volume gives you density.
Huh.
So the underlying assumption of underwater weighing is that the density of the body fat is 0.9. The density of water is 1 at 12 to 13 degrees Celsius or something like that. Changes upon temperature. And the density of the fat-free mass, so you've got fat and everything else.
Yeah.
The fat-free mass is 1.1.
Okay.
And so that's the underlying underlying idea. And when you take someone and you weigh them on dry land, and then you weigh them underwater,
mm-hmm.
you can figure out, you get the amount of buoyancy that they have. It'll tell you what their density is. And then if you make the assumption that it's the only fat and fat-free mass, you can sort of say, well, if the fat's this dense and the fat-free mass is this dense and this is how much they weigh underwater, this is how much fat they are and this is how much fat-free mass they are.
Okay.
But the assumption about fat is pretty close, although it's not always true. It's the one about fat-free mass can be all over the place. So, like, for instance, the density of skeletal muscle tissue, I believe, is 1.06.
All right.
The density of bone is 1.34.
Huh.
And there are quote-unquote racial differences in the density of the fat-free mass. So there are some equations where they look at if the person's black or African-American, however they categorize them, they presume a different, because you can figure this out other ways, the different density of that fat-free mass.
No kidding.
So you take someone like Ronnie Coleman, and here's the other thing, is that those numbers were plugged in. There's two main equations. There's one called the Siri. People can look this up if they want. Siri and the Brozek equations. The Siri equation was a way to take that underwater weighing information and convert that based on what they found in cadavers. And so the assumption then was that you can take anybody, and those, it was six male cadavers, is representative of pretty much anybody you put in the dunk tank. Well, those six cadavers were like average-sized people. There's only six of them, six people, to create this Siri equation. I think the Brozek was similar to that.
Okay.
And none of those people were 303-pound bodybuilders or 295-pound bodybuilders, looked like Ronnie Coleman.
Yeah.
So the underlying assumptions of the density, which differs by race, which I hate that word, we're all the human race, but that's kind of what you, how you have to say it. And especially someone who carries that much muscle mass is so friggin' far off.
Okay.
That you can end up, if you just apply these equations, which don't really fit Ronnie Coleman,
yeah,
you throw him in the dunk tank. There's also an equation, they may or may not have measured how much the volume of air in his lungs.
Okay.
So you can measure, you can't measure that directly. It's not like you can like take a, like a shop vac and empty someone's lungs of the air and figure out how much volume it is.
Right.
They'll have to do shit like use oxygen or nitrogen and have them breathe in and out and see how much it dilutes based, and that will tell you what the volume is.
Yeah.
So if it's a large volume, it will dilute to a different concentration, whether it's a small volume of your lungs, or you can just base it on the size. That varies. So there's all these assumptions that are just like all over the place. If you're confused, it's like, yes, because it's very confusing, the shitload of assumptions. You put someone like Ronnie Coleman, who basically violates the assumptions every which way to Sunday, and yeah, you can get a number that's 0.33%, which obviously is physically impossible.
Yeah.
Just because your cell membranes are all made of phospholipids.
Okay.
They're mostly fat. You have essential fat is considered to be like 4% of your body fat.
So can you sum that back up in a really simple way? Because
sure.
I'm kind of with you, but I would love to hear it restated.
I could tell you what your body fat percentage is, but in order to do that, I'd have to kill you. So instead, they use the dunk tank to figure out what your density is, which can give you an estimation of your body fat percentage. But there's a whole boatload of assumptions that are underlie that equation, that calculation, which is just an estimation, which Ronnie Coleman is an obvious exception to. He's an exception to almost everything you can think of when it comes to physics. The guy never gets sick. Like, he literally said that on the Joe Rogan show. Ronnie's like, I don't get sick. And Joe's like, I like how you said it. It's like, no, I've only been sick like two or three times my entire life.
Huh.
He just doesn't get sick because he's got like this alien immune system, you know?
Yeah.
It's like Superman. So anyway, there is actually, and I posted this on my Instagram. We may have even talked about it here before, but I did, a DEXA a long ago when I was in grad school. You remember this?
I remember the conversation.
Yeah, I did one recently, and that was like for one of my shows last year, and it put me at...
It was like 8 or something? Was that the one?
No, that was like off-season one, I think. That was quote-unquote off-season. That was like 4 or something, 4 or 6.
On DEXA, okay.
I remember when
you did one a while, this is some time ago, like back when Jordan was even on the show still, and that... It said you were like 7 or 8, but I would have guessed you were like 4 if you asked me by the way you looked. Your thing was to say, hey guys, this is what a real 7% looks like. And like, you look like body, you look stage ready, you know?
Yeah. Well, I was, there's a video I posted from the gym with this other one that I did when I was, it was like really close to a show. It was like the week of a show.
That was more recently. Yeah. That was like a year ago or something.
But I did one when I was in grad school. We had a body comp lab.
Okay.
One of the Kirk Curitan, who was the department head for a while, body comp was one of his major areas of research interest. So
yeah,
he had all the stuff there. They tested out bioelectrical impedance machines for people like, you know, industry research work. Huh. And they had access. There's a DEXA across campus in the nutrition department that he would go to. And they would test people. So we did underwater weighing, we did DEXA, we did skin folds. Skin folds actually, well, here's skin folds as an aside. Skin folds estimate what your body density would be if you got an estimate going underwater. Huh. So the skin folds are an estimate of an estimate. Wow. So they can be way the fuck off.
Yeah.
Yeah. So none of them, they're all indirect. But the, so we did all those. We did Bod Pod. This was really funny. Oh, yeah. This is when the Bod Pod first came out. And they've since changed. They don't tell you these are this is proprietary industry information. So we used, I think it was a Hologic. There's Lunar, there's Hologic, and there's one other brand name I can't remember for the DEXA, like three brands. And they won't tell you what their underlying calculations are.
Huh.
They go and like this Siri equation that is used for like the Dernan-Walmersley and the Jackson and Pollock equations, people who study extra science will know exactly what I mean, or people who do a lot of skin folds, they probably use the Jackson-Pollock equations. Hmm. Those are all based on some original sample, which is kind of representative of your average person, but they don't have extremes like Ronnie Coleman in the sample, so they make huge errors. And you go like the Bod Pod, they wouldn't tell you like exactly what they're doing. The Bod Pod actually just gives you an estimate of body density. Hmm. And then applies a Siri equation to the Brozek, or at least that's how they used to do it.
Okay.
It was just another way. It's called air plethysmography. It's just another way to get body density, which is really funny. So it's really not any better, although it looks cool.
Yeah.
You look like you're, you know, Robin Williams coming out from space. It's Mort from Ork, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just all they do is there's like a little membrane in the back of that thing that moves, like you can hear it kind of move around, and it measures the extent to which the air compresses when it's empty versus when you're in there. And if you're in there, you're taking up some space. So you move that membrane a certain amount, and with less volume occupied in the rest of the cavity, it changes the amount of pressure that you change that you find. The bigger you are, the more the change, the smaller you are, the less you change. So just measure your volume. You weigh yourself on the scale. You get mass, you get volume, you get density, and then you apply the same equations.
Yeah.
Same shit. Just don't have to get wet. So anyway, we did the DEXA way back when. This was like probably like 97 or 98. I have the have it someplace. And they, again, like no people of extreme body comp. And I did this 2 weeks after my very first show.
Okay.
And I knew that we were going to do the body comp lab. So it kind of sucked because I finished the show and then I wanted to just eat, you know?
Yeah.
And so I kind of kept myself close, and we did underwater weighing and I was like 4%. We did skin folds. I was like 4%. And I think the bioelectrical impedance was all I don't remember whether that one was, but we did a four component model, but, and that's a whole other story that we won't bore people with. But the Bod Pod put me at 16%.
Oh.
Which was interesting. Yeah. There was a guy who apparently was like this. He was like, he'd won the Mr. Georgia NPC that year. Uh-huh. So super heavy, like who was going on to compete and hopefully get his pro card at the USA's. And he went in to get his body fat done. And they told him he was like 14% or something like that.
Hopefully he didn't have to pay for that.
Yeah, like he got his money back. It's like, that's bullshit. Yeah. And they do regional body fat percentage on the DEXA. And so you get left and right leg, and they did torso. And on my torso, I think it was negative 2.4%.
Okay.
Huh. Negative.
Yeah.
That's impossible.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't have that. So it's because, like, Ronnie Coleman's negative 2%.
Yeah.
It's because, like, that's just impossible. You can't have that. It's because the equations don't fit someone who is that lean, or in his case, that big.
Interesting.
So, and the machine, it wasn't smart enough
to
weed out like an impossible number. Like, it just, like, that wasn't something that the you know, the computer was set up to do and say, well, you know, not NA or something like that, not applicable.
Yeah.
And it was just because I was so far outside of the sample population was from which they come up with those equations. I mean, imagine, like, you think of this, like, what's a way to estimate someone's IQ, you know, and you ask you know, 100 questions, like not a real IQ test, kind of a generic one. And you, the people you want to figure out how well your estimation works, their IQs are like from like 80 to 120.
Hmm.
And so, and then you come in and you test someone like Einstein. I think he was supposed to be like 160, you know, or John von Neumann, who was like 200 plus. Well, he gets all of them right.
Yeah.
He doesn't have an IQ of 120. He has an IQ of 200. So it gives him the wrong number because the people that they used to set up the equations weren't representative of those people you're testing. So Ronnie Coleman, they shouldn't be testing Ronnie underwater. Probably couldn't even test Ronnie. Well, he couldn't fit on the DEXA. They'd have to do a double scan with him probably. because sometimes people are too big. So anyway, that's important. So people can maybe pay attention to that, because everyone's like, they're calling Ronnie a liar and this kind of stuff. Like they're claiming that he was ignorant. And I think he knows that you can't have negative percent body fat. He was just telling what the, it was sort of making fun of the numbers that they gave him.
Okay. That's what you got the vibe of, that he was.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Okay. Like, yeah, they told me negative. And like, Ronnie, I mean, Ronnie's an easygoing guy, and he has an accounting degree. He's not an idiot. He knows numbers.
Yeah, there you go. And he has no reason to fabricate or lie about things either, you know?
No.
Listen, we got a bunch of questions that piled up here on the thread itself. We don't have a lot of time, but I want to jump to a couple of them here, because I think there's some fun stuff. Okay. Now, for those of you guys that don't know, Scott had actually coached Jordan Peters. How long was that period of time for that you worked with Jordan?
I think we worked together twice. Because I talk with Jordan all the time, so it kind of gets all blurred together. But
yeah,
I think he did two shows.
Okay, you did two shows, and you helped him to grow as well, right? Like you helped.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, well, there was the off season when he went from like 218 or something like that to 285.
Okay.
So like kind of his big. I think I think he'd been like in maybe 250s before that, but it was like a big. Like we had him at like close to 10,000 calories a day for a while, and then when we dieted down, that's when he got his NABA Pro card.
Okay.
And that might have been like 2016 or something.
Well, here's the question. Hi guys, great show. I have a question. Jordan Peters said that he made the biggest gains in his life after he was coached by Scott and Milos. Was he using the 4 day a week fortitude training split, and what was his diet like to take him over 300 pounds?
When he was working with Milos, he was doing Milos's training, I believe.
Okay.
Or maybe not. I don't know.
I couldn't picture him doing giant sets. It just doesn't.
I know there's some video of him doing some of those, and maybe he didn't do that. I think maybe he started and then he's like, nah.
Yeah, I can see that. But
he didn't get above. Yeah, he didn't. I mean, because it's just like, it's just not going to work for him. He knows that now. But he never got above 300 with me. That was with Milos. So. Okay. They're kind of like blending the two together, but we were doing DC training.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah. This was actually before the book came out, I think. Pretty sure it was.
Okay.
Not 99% sure it was. So we were just doing DC training. I think the two-way split, maybe the three-way split. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, let's talk about that. When he went to did you say 280, 285?
It was 285, I think.
285 from 219.
So it was something like, yeah, I didn't remember. Like, he's posted that because he knew, but
yeah.
I just knew we're going to get big as fuck, you know, because he's a fucking machine. He will do the people stuff that, like, basically almost no one else would do.
Yeah.
Which he still demonstrates to this day.
What do you mean? Give me an example of that. Like,
well,
when did you say to yourself, like, oh, he's different in the way that in what he's willing to do?
Good question. It was the nature of the exchange. I mean, Jordan's he's you know, outside of the gym where, you know, he's an absolute monster. He, very, very polite, he would ask questions in a way that really matched how I like to kind of educate people.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, sometimes ask rhetorical questions to him to get him thinking, but he was always asking about things. So we had a really good working relationship where, you know, I was, and that was the time too, I was refining some of the things I do, like, you know, which meal do you think you could add this food to? Because we had to, because I couldn't just say, okay, like, let's add some food in meal six. It was because he's already at 7,000 calories.
Holy crap.
You know?
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. He was up. I think we went up close to 10,000 calories.
Wow.
A day with him. So he, you know, he was both willing dude to do whatever, but also very, very good with giving me feedback as to what was going on. So sometimes you'll have people who don't want to come across as complainers, and as clients, you probably have run into this, and then they don't tell you shit that's going on. And like, next thing you know, they've got all sorts of GI distress and like, they can't sleep at night. And you're like, I need to know this stuff. Like,
When did it start?
Yeah, I'm not. We're not here to like see how long you can go without uttering a peep.
Yeah.
You know, the idea is we want to work with your body as much as possible because this is a delicate process.
Okay.
As much as you're forcing something, it is still a delicate process.
Yeah.
On the other side of the coin. So, and Jordan was just absolutely dead set that he was going to beat the logbook every time he went in the gym, which he still is.
Yeah.
You know, he's still like a lot of those, like all this, all the sort of things that we were doing are things that he, I mean, he knew. We learned these are things that, you know, I had come to know and that, you know, Dante had professed, and that's, you know, that's, and I had been doing DC training for a while too. Hmm. And seeing how for most of the time, I think I was getting them emails that Dante would send the day after a while, I didn't need to, but, so I was privy to how Dante did things.
Yeah.
And I knew what worked for me, and Jordan came to learn, and the evidence showed that when you go when you gain 65 pounds, in 9 months or however long it was, and so much of it is muscle and size, that is a functioning formula for you.
Yeah, no kidding, so, man.
And he was willing to do that. He he trusted me.
Yeah.
And so it was just like everything was lined up exactly as you would want it to be.
Hmm.
So his check-ins were always, you know, dead on, you know, everything was just, he was just immaculate.
Hmm.
In all of those things. But not everyone could do what he's willing to do.
Hmm.
Most people, 10,000 calories, like some people couldn't do that just once.
Yeah.
He had to work his way up. And it was like, I mean, he'd get anxious before meals.
Yeah.
He's talked about this, I think, before.
Okay.
And I've been there too, you know, and he'd have, you know, there have been times when I've been pushing the food when I'd been in bed for 3 or 4 hours and I'd throw up.
Mm.
Like I'd wake up with vomit in my mouth because I just like I had so much food in my belly from the day's worth of food. I'm like, damn it. Like it's the worst feeling. All of a sudden you've got a mouthful of vomit and you're like, ugh. Well, I probably should carry this to the bathroom,
ugh.
You know, because you're just pushing everything. But you learn, okay, now I need to take some digestive enzymes in,
yeah,
you know, before I go to bed or what have you. So it was just it was someone, and Jordan, he doesn't have like premier, like Flex Wheeler, Ronnie Coleman type genetics.
Yeah.
If he did, he wouldn't have had to do what we did, you know?
Yeah.
But he does have genetics of the right mindset, and he has the ability to push in a way that some people won't. And that's really, but he has got good genetics to respond to that too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's you know? Got to be true too, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and he's a hardy guy, like the things he pushes himself through.
Mm.
Although he did push himself too far, and he documented this on his discussion board this last, I think it was all in 2019, maybe part of the year, but we talked about it a good bit because I've done the same thing. Like, he pushed himself to the point of like this sort of, it's like a systemic inflammatory syndrome as well. I'll just give it a name right now. I just came up with that. Where you're just fucking achy everywhere. Like everything fucking hurts all the time.
Yeah.
Constantly. And it's because you just trained so hard and pushed so far, so much food. And he had to stop training. Like there's lots of videos and you can look on his Instagram where he just went to the gym with Corin to help her.
Wow.
And normally they would train together.
Yeah.
So like he had that willingness to kind of push way beyond what most people would do,
yeah,
and the ability to adapt to that.
Yeah, to a place so. Most people would never go to. And
I
could see that, the ability to adapt to it. All right,
yeah.
Let's see, what else do we have here? If I can throw anything else out that would be interesting. Let's see, there's a question about... okay, here's one that I think would be interesting to tackle, Scott. Just give me your thoughts overall on this one. Where would you recommend grip width on behind the neck presses for best delt activation and least tricep activation?
Behind the neck presses. Well, the first thing to consider there is whether you should be doing behind the neck presses.
I was wondering where you're
going to
go. That's why.
That's in the first place. So those work great for some people who have the flexibility to do that. They work phenomenally well. And I knew a guy in grad school, actually. I think he's a strength coach at one of the schools in the University of Texas system.
Yeah.
And really, really cool guy. And I spent a year working down at the Newhouse Royal Complex in UT Austin with my buddies who were all, they were all GAs. I was just doing the regular thing, but I got to do an internship down there for a while. And so we trained every once in a while. I'd spot him, and he would do, he was like maybe 200 pounds, pretty lean. He was like, he was 45 or 50. We used to, you know, we used to call, just laughed about how old he was.
Okay.
But he kept his shoulders really flexible and healthy. Huh. And he would do sets of 2 1/4 behind the neck press all the way down to his traps.
No kidding.
For sets of 10.
Wow.
But he had the flexibility to do that.
Yeah.
So biomechanically speaking, obviously the closer you come in together, the more triceps you're going to use. The further out you go, the less triceps are going to be involved. Mm-hmm. Some of that's just, it's just the mechanics of it. It's the angle through which the elbow is going during the course of the range of motion. You start here and you go all the way down, like imagine it's behind the neck, but you've got a lot, you've basically full excursion at the elbow. Whereas you start here, you go all the mm-hmm. way down. You've got a shorter range of motion in terms of what the bar does, but you only get half of the change.
Yeah.
So you can figure out what that means in terms of workload that has to be carried, so to speak, by the elbow extensors, the triceps.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing. Most people probably going anything with the bar going below like the top or maybe the middle of your ears is probably not the best idea.
Okay.
So, but this is just a matter of feel. Probably if you can do those and get away with them and go behind the neck without like crank your neck forward, then, yeah. You know, just literally so that you're just about close to 90 at the elbow uh-huh. when you're at that height with the bar behind
yeah.
your neck
yeah.
at your head. So here, you go too far here, this becomes triceps, you go too far there, and then your range of motion is just so shitty, you know, you're not getting a great range of motion. Not that you can't grow that way, mm-hmm. but you ever see how Marcus Rule used to do chest presses?
I don't remember offhand.
Yeah, I think it's like the Made in Germany video, but he used to go super, super, super wide.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and he would also arch. He also kind of like did sort of an arch in his upper back a little bit, but he'd allow his scapula to come down
uh-huh.
a little, just to sort of, it made some of it a serratus anterior and a, you know, not so much a pec exercise per se, but increased the range of motion when he had this really, really super wide grip.
No kidding.
He was also using like 5 plates, you know, for sets of 10 or whatever. He's strong as shit.
Of course he was, yeah.
And he had an awesome chest until he started to tear it a little bit there mm-hmm. at the end.
Okay.
Started to separate from his sternum. But so not that you can't do that so much with an overhead press, yeah. but you can go wide. But the main thing with that, that's one of those exercises where if you're lucky enough that you can still do it without like messing up your shoulders,
yeah.
then pick the hand position that feels the most comfortable for you, as long as you feel like you're getting what you need from the delts, the anterior delts are the weak link in the exercise.
Yeah.
So this is a good, just standard place to start. This obviously ends up being, you can actually do, I do these as a tricep exercise. It's actually sort of a DC related strategy. You can do close grip overhead presses.
Okay. Yeah.
So let's say like the thing people will talk about is like, let's say you want more chest work in a DC training split where you're training frequently and you don't have a lot of exercises you're doing.
Yeah.
So for your triceps work, you would use a close grip chest press.
Okay.
Because you get a little bit of extra chest work that way.
Yeah.
Well, you can accomplish that same thing, whether it's DC or fortitude training or any sort of kind of abbreviated high frequency, lower volume type of approach. If you want to get more delt work, but you're doing it as primarily tricep exercise, go close. Overhead tricep, close grip tricep on a Smith machine usually feels best.
Okay.
Those are great.
Yeah.
So you could even do hex presses that way too, but you want to not hit yourself in the head with a dumbbell.
I've done that with triceps before like that.
Yeah.
Those are good.
Yeah.
Those are good.
That actually feels pretty good too.
It's a nice stretch.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'll grab one more here.
All right.
This is from, I can't remember how to say his name. I don't know. Sigan.
I can't even. I think thread
it's,
here.
So. I think it's Sigan Dairy, the guy who I mentioned at the beginning of the show.
Oh, okay.
I currently take several adaptogens, and they're in powder form as they are much cheaper, but it's getting annoying to spoon feed three of these to myself several times a day. Is there an inert liquid solution that I could use, that I could add to this, such as alcohol, that won't damage or alter the supplements?
If they're just in powdered bags, I would just mix them all together in the right proportions.
Okay.
You know, like let's say it's two tablespoons of one and one of the other.
Right.
You know, just take you take the ones that are the one, figure out which is going to be the limiting in terms of what you have at home, and then just combine them all twice of the first one and one of the other. So weigh it out. You know,
and then
so let's say it's. And that's it's a tablespoon is what he does. So there's two, one, and one.
Yeah.
So a tablespoon of one is 10 grams. A tablespoon of the other two are 8 grams. So he's basically getting 20 grams and 8 grams and 8 grams.
Okay.
So that's his ratio. It's 20, 8, and 8. And he's got buying them in 1 kilo bottles. Well, then that means he's going to have 2 kilos of the other one and 0.8 kilos and 0.8 kilos of the other one. Get a big ass fucking jug like you get from True Nutrition if you order something from them, maybe. Or maybe it's just a big like food grade bag. They have those too. I think you maybe just order the bags, or just, you know, something you can store it in, and put 2 kilos of one in there. Actually, probably put like a half a kilo and then,
but then,
you know, half of the other, half the other. What's that?
Then what though? Because he's asking.
Then you shake it all up.
But then what? He doesn't want to take powder.
Well, hold on. I'm getting
there. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's two ways. I mean, part of the problem, I think, is that he has to do one each time. Like, he's got a bunch of them. It could be five things. Like, scoop from each bag.
So pre-mix
them. You pre-mix them all together. Yeah.
Okay.
That's why people buy all sorts of supplements that are pre-made with them.
Because it's less
work. It's my pre-workout, but then it's got five ingredients in there. Well, you buy the five ingredients from True Nutrition, use the Advices Radio code, which gives you 5% off your purchases, and then you can recombine those in whatever way you want to.
Yeah.
So, you can do that. Like, a smart way to do that, I've had people do this before, not with such large amounts, because it depends on how much he's taking these. If it's like just a raw powder and it's big, he doesn't want to use a bunch of alcohol. He's kind of like, he'll end up doing like a shot of alcohol to get as much in there. Like he'll end up drunk before he goes to work out. Yeah, maybe before he goes to bed at night. I don't know. But you can also get like an adrenal tonic.
Okay.
Or let's something with like licorice usually, or like a liver tonic.
Huh.
If he's using small amounts here, like, you know, a gram or less or something like that of each of these in the powder form. And then you combine those. You can get like 4 ounce bottles of like a liver tonic. Let's say he, you know, takes a liver tonic that's got, you know, silymarin in it, milk thistle or whatever other things. And then he adds that in whatever concentration he wants things to be in.
Okay.
So then he uses a dropper. So the smart way then would be, let's say most droppers are like 1 mil.
Yeah.
So let's say he's got, there's about 28 milliliters in an ounce.
Yeah.
So he's going to have like about 112 1 milliliter drops. It'll probably stay 112 or whatever milliliters on there. So he's going to have to do a little math, have to figure this out. But let's say he wants to have, 200 milligrams, 100 milligrams, and 100 milligrams.
Uh-huh.
So he wants to have 400 milligrams in every mil.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to take up a certain amount of volume, but he can figure out, given the total volume of the bottle, and how much of those he wants to put in there, pour a little bit out into a bowl or something like that, and then load your powders in, or load the pre-mixed powder, if you've already done it that way, and put that in there so that you have, let's say it's 100 mils, not 112.
Yeah.
So you'd want to have the equivalent of 100 doses in that bottle. Pour half the stuff out, throw 100 doses in, make sure that you're not playing with numbers that are impossible. Like you're trying to put like massive amount of powder in the bottle. It won't fit.
Yeah.
And then just add the liquid back, fill it to the same area, same volume that it once was. And now you've got 100 doses in 100 mils. So you got one dose per mil.
There you go. Yeah.
Take that shit up each time, pull the dropper out, put it in your mouth, and you're good to go.
There you go.
And you got the liver thing going on at the same time.
Yeah. Why not?
Which you might want.
as a bonus too. So
yeah,
okay. So you could mix it into an existing tincture type
yeah,
compound.
The alcohol is best for
okay
for getting those things to dissolve a lot of times.
Yeah, I've seen
people just use Everclear.
I was gonna say Everclear, or even like some things will even work with like a Bacardi 151. That
right.
can work too, you know. Depending, I think, on the product, how much it is. I think,
yeah.
You know, if you had a lot, you might need something stronger. But there's some options for you.
There's a couple things. One, if you go on Amazon where you buy it and like read the comments, like some of that stuff is nasty.
Yeah.
And I have one. I don't know if I threw the bottle away or not, but it's good. It's a liver thing, and it tastes good. It's just like not a bad one to have.
Yeah.
So if you add it to that, then you don't mind doing three drops or whatever.
Yeah.
Because Everclear and Bacardi tastes like shit.
It's going to be it's going to be
potent. Everclear's nasty by itself. It's fucking horrible.
I know the research chem companies use like a PEG, but that stuff tastes terrible too. Like like battery acid, terrible.
Right. Right. And then,
but that is available. That would be technically an option. That is something you could use.
Yeah.
And that stuff is, you know, you can find it.
If he's taken all the powder and mixed it together, so like maybe he has like one tablespoon or whatever to use.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've told you this trick before, but so this works with like have you ever tried pantothenic acid, like vitamin B5?
No.
It helps with acne?
Yeah.
Yeah. You could take it as the pills and it's fine, but it's really cheap as powder.
Okay.
And it's just fucking horrible. It's just like... You should turn – it tastes so bad it should make you into the Hulk afterwards, because like this stuff is just terrible. But you can you can get that down if you fill your mouth with water, and you have to have the right size scoop so you can get in. So your mouth is full of water.
Oh, you've told me this trick before. Yeah.
So you let it kind of sink into the water and then you just swallow it all and chase it really fast.
Yeah.
So he could do that too if he just mixes the powder and it's too much to put in a tincture. You can do it that way. Sometimes you could just mix shit in with the drink too. That works.
Yeah, that could work.
You know, like a greens thing.
Sure.
And then just slam the whole thing. But
all right. Well, with that, let's get out of here for another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. Check out fortitudetraining.net, byobbcoach.com, and of course, check out our great sponsors, truenutrition.com, user code advices, and check out getazoff.com, advices10. We'll see you guys. Thanks, Scott.
Adios.